The journey is conversations with ordinary people about stories of transformation and how we may have had setbacks in our life and how we persevered through those, how we've learned from those obstacles, and how they've, you know, maybe helped us on our path today. Welcome to The Journey. Today I have a very special guest with us, Anna Marie Candelero. And she, Anna Marie, and I have worked together in the past. I had an opportunity while she was administrator at a school district called Melrose Park in the Maywood School District, and it's a suburb of Chicago. And I had an opportunity to work with her for a couple of years with a behavioral intervention specialist as well as social workers. And it had been just a delight to be able to work with you during that time period. Actually, it was pre-pandemic and then the early parts of the pandemic, if I remember correctly. So, so Anna Marie, thank you for joining us on the journey today.
Thank you for having me. I'm big Kevin fan, so this is exciting to spend some time with you. So,
well, thank you very much. Yeah. And like I said, I thoroughly enjoyed our time together when we worked together in Maywood. That was it was an awesome experience, and I learned so much about the school district and the community as a whole, and then the BIS. They were just awesome to work with. They were an awesome group.
And just think about our numbers, Kevin. Prior to us working together, doing that support group for them, our retention rate for behavior specialists was 45%. And after that group, our retention rate was 85% for social workers and behavior specialists. So spending that time with case consultation and then just talking about wellness and gratitude goes a long way, because we definitely saw it in our retention.
That is awesome. I know that, you know, that when we got, you know, when I was asked to come in and do that, I know it was a little bit out of the box, training and that aspect of it. And I know that for some, it was a little bit probably uncomfortable to be invited to be that vulnerable during those meetings. But to your point, I think ultimately it's like anything. We are going to get what we put into it. We're going to get out of it what we put into it. And the ones that did do that hard work of being vulnerable and being courageous enough to do that, I think they definitely benefited.
It did. And I think it was also good to have a leader. So as we recall, I was a supervisor at the time. So I was in a space as a leader being with the behavior specialist. And so that vulnerability from a leader, and then being in that space with them to also ground me in the work that they're doing on the ground was super important. And so that really helped us build our relationships in hard, difficult times. And so that was another reasoning that I really felt that this was a purposeful time to spend with them. Good memories, good memories.
Yeah, well, you know, while we're on that topic, why don't we maybe give kind of a little bit of a setting about Melrose or Maywood School District? Maybe talk a little bit about if you can lay some of the landscape of what were some of the struggles, what were some of the demographics that were playing some challenges and some barriers to helping these young individuals.
Sure. Melrose Maywood Park was a very diverse community district, so predominantly Latino and Black community. I would say it was split by railroad tracks too, because the communities were split half and half. And so we had, that intersectionality of already on top of, poverty, low achievement scores. And so predominantly teachers that are white working with students of color. So there was a lot of things interplay, and because of the high needs in that community, it impacted our educators. So we're thinking about, when we think about our adverse childhood experiences, many of those students were experiencing, neglect, abuse, mental health illness. And so, we were, as educators, the front line. So when we're thinking about social workers and behavior specialists, We were the front line dealing with those crisis calls, dealing with the behaviors that stem from mental illness. And so it was rough. Like, we spent a lot of time, working with kids in mental illness. We had a great partnership with one of the nearby comprehensive hospitals, but I mean, we were in the thick of it for many years, and that was prior to COVID. And so our team was again getting that secondary trauma and experiencing that. And so we had to figure out a creative way to not only support the students, but support the staff that was encountering these day to day. It was day to day, and sometimes, the intensity was, really hard. And so that was just one of the things that, with that kind of demographic, it was just, hard to manage, because it was rough, for a while there.
Well, and I think of, that on the ground level, that the expectations that the teachers had on, or the things that they were dealing with regarding what the students were bringing with them on a daily basis and a weekly basis, and all the different factors that were playing with that. And then there's still the expectations that the superintendent and the principals were required to also place on it, and metaphorically, these kids were on fire in a burning building. I mean, that's and on a regular basis. And to your point, the educators, the teachers, as well as the support staff, there was a lot of their own secondary trauma, not only with the stories that they were hearing, but how are they able to even make a difference? How are they even, am I even doing anything? And I just remember some of those stories and how they did such a great job of leaning into each other and learning how to lean into each other, even if they didn't get to see each other other than, the times when we would be together because they were so so busy and so split apart,
Right. And it was just a safe place. I mean, I don't know, we could remember all the tears in that group. I mean, it was just a safe space to release. And that was powerful in itself, just to have that relief and not to feel guilty about how we're feeling and how we're being impacted. And I think, when we start talking, in a little bit about my journey, that's something that I always think about, is that it's so important that we are vulnerable and we share our stories, because it does create a space for others to welcome them in and bring them in. But then also it helps us grow. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, but that was such a growing experience for me, as a leader, to really be part of that. And I want to continue that with other leaders when, when I'm coaching leaders and when I'm supporting leaders in my current director position, is saying that it's okay not to be okay, and how do we grow from that?
Yeah.
And that's one of the key messages. I'm getting ahead of myself, but it's really important.
Yeah. Well, let's just give the audience a little bit of background on who Anna Marie is. And so yeah, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how did you discover this idea of wanting to be an educator and then obviously now in leadership positions. So yeah, tell us a little bit about growing. Anna Marie is a little girl.
As a little girl, oh my
Yeah.
gosh. So, I grew up in Chicago, in the city, the actual Chicago. I know some people are like, "I'm from Chicago." No, I really was from Chicago, in the city. And so I grew up, from predominantly a Puerto Rican Italian household. My dad, and I'm very open about speaking about, my family dynamics, but my dad had left me when I was two. And so I am a child of abandonment, if you would say that. He eventually did come in my picture, but that left me and my mom in a single, single mom, one bedroom apartment in a basement in my aunt's building for probably until I was like 10, and my mom remarried. And so, with a single mom, I was raised by a village. So, she was working long hours, doing what she needed to do for our family. And here I was, doing my job, and that was her, like, "Anna Marie, make sure you go to school, make sure you complete your homework, make sure you achieve, make sure you do these things." And so that was a huge part. Achievement and self-motivation, was something that I needed as a child, because I was there surrounded by adults. And so that was a huge piece of me growing up. And leading me to being a teacher and an educator, a leader, was not some, beautiful story. I actually, in high school, I shared my story with some high schoolers that when I was in high school, I got picked on and bullied because I wasn't Latina enough, I wasn't white enough. And so that was a huge struggle since elementary, trying to find myself and find my footing, until I had a fifth grade teacher, Miss Mendez, who was also multiracial and married a Puerto Rican man. And so she knew what her children were going through. And so she sat with me during my fifth grade lunch, the entire year, because as like a safe person and protected me. And so, that was huge for me, having that one core safe person. And you'll hear in my story on how I really rely on safe people, safe places, safe ideas. And so that was a huge part. And then going into high school, I mean, it wasn't any easier. I had got a scholarship to go to an all-girls school where I got severely bullied during that time. And I begged my mom to unenroll me and to get me into a public school. And so I'm very pro public education, although it didn't help me out as I wish it would. But even in high school, I was in honors classes, AP classes, and I saw a bunch of students, getting accepted to large universities, getting their counselors really to help them with recommendations. And I talk about this because it was so key in my life, was that my counselor offered me a community college brochure. And I was in the same honors classes and APs classes as my counterparts, my white counterparts. And so that was really hard for me because I knew something was wrong. I'm like, why? Why do they get to go there? And then I have to go here. That seems wrong to me. So I'm going to figure it out myself, which was hard because, my parents, I'm a first generation high school graduate, college graduate. And so that was hard because I didn't know what I was doing. They were like, fill out financial aid. And I was like, okay, let me see where this takes me. Sure. And the private loans and all of that years later leads me into eight colleges. So my story called Eight Colleges Later, I legit had to navigate secondary institutions on my own and encounter microaggressions, racism from my professors, because I just didn't find that place for me. And so with all of these, I found, I don't know if I told you about this, Kevin, but I wanted to be a counselor. I wanted to be a mental health counselor. And I'll never forget, I was going to a university, I won't name drop, but in an interview, the lady said to me, your background looks pretty unstable. And I was like, ooh, unstable, what does that even mean? And she was like, well, you've bounced around a lot, in different houses, and you've changed your colleges a lot. And I said, but that's what's going to make me an amazing counselor. Like, I have different backgrounds. I've moved around a lot because of my family life, and this is going to be great. And she goes, I don't think you're going to be a right fit for our university. And so I gave up that counselor dream. I already had a bachelor's in psychology. I was super heartbroken. So then I tried a public university, and they said, well, in order to fix your future, you need to fix your past. And I was like, well, these people led me to my past. Like, how do I fix these college credits? And like, how do I get into a master's program? So I had some time seeking, and that's when I realized I don't want to be a counselor. I want to be a teacher. I was working in a therapeutic school. I was working as a behavior specialist. And I thought about it, and I was like, in order, I want to get ahead of the game. I don't want to get behind the game. And so I became, and I went as a student at large to a university for a special education teacher. And that's how I ended up getting into the master's program of special education in Northeastern University, Illinois University. And so I'll stop right there to give myself a breather. And but really, that's how I ended up in teaching, was a lot of people telling me that I couldn't do something. And knowing me as like, watch me,
Well, and I think of just you sharing a little bit of that part of your story, and then knowing you with when we work together, that I don't, as they say, things don't happen accidentally. And it's more about what do you do with the cards that you're dealt. And your mom, she needed to do what she needed to do for you guys to survive, and you were intuitive enough, empathic enough to be able to pick up on either you could contribute to the hardships or you could do your part. Which as we think about it now as adults looking at a small child of 8, 9 years old, it's how does an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 7-year-old even know how to, other than, be good and work as hard as you can, and but we pick up on those things and we know that we can at least do that part to not add an additional burden to mom and an additional and then in your case, it doesn't sound like you were often getting affirmed or validated for the work that you were doing. So it wasn't like you were getting all this natural, benefits of doing that. It was still you still were pushing against the wind.
And that didn't come out, Kevin, until honestly recently, a year later, where, I'm very open about I am a person that supports therapy and mental health. And so when my own therapist said to me, you have been protecting yourself as a child for, you were playing the adult role and when you were in your developing years, you have taken on that throughout now your adulthood. And I was like, whoa. So like I'm thinking here that like I'm intrinsic motivator. I live, by achievement of my own. I don't need any of this praise from people. And to my demise, was that I did really truly need that. I just was protecting myself from saying, it's okay. I don't need it. I got me. But really I did need it. And so that was important to step out and be like, I need people to take care of me. I've been taking care of myself and others for so long. And so I had to realize that in my late 30s, a lot of time passing by
Yeah.
for sure.
Well, I think there's something to be said about that, right? So we grow accustomed. That's our familiar. And then we even use internal language or dialogue of saying that, oh, it's okay, or we don't expect it, or it would be weak if I needed that, or phrases like that we tell ourselves when it doesn't happen, when in reality, to be vulnerable enough to admit that we do want slash need that, that's a pretty scary spot. So tell us a little bit about that. So I mean, feel free to because I there's a question I want to jump to a little bit later, but maybe kind of set the tone for, you've always, ever since I've known you always give 100 plus. I know there's no such thing of being able to give more than 100%, but you're like pushing you're redlining it, and I know that there has been times when that has paid a price on you physically, clearly has paid a price, emotionally as well. So maybe tell us a little bit, kind of maybe set the tone for what has gone on the last couple of years since the pandemic. And I know you and I want to say, because I was still at Maywood with you, I think it was 21, spring of 21, right around that is when that's when that contract ended. And so, and I know soon after that, there was quite a bit of attrition that happened within the district, especially at the leadership level. So so why don't you kind of catch our audience up to what's gone on the last couple of years?
Where do I begin? This has been a long few years, right? One thing I'm really open again, like that when I talk about mental health. Prior to COVID, during all of that, Kevin, when you were working with me, I was struggling with postpartum depression. I just had a child. I was trying to figure out how to be a mom, how to be a leader, how to, be a person, figure out my identity. And again, I was grasping on work was my identity. Work was my achievement. Work was, I'm going to go all into work because that's what makes me happy. And I did it for a while. So when we talk about people were feeling it for the pandemic and feeling lonely and isolated, I didn't because I already just went through 18 months of feeling lonely and isolated as a new mom. And so when I went into the pandemic, I was like, got this. Like, this is fine because everybody was finally feeling what I was feeling. And so, you know, that was almost kind of a relief going through the pandemic, I could say. Because I felt people were with me and understood what I was going through. And I don't want to wish anything bad on anybody, but it's a lonely, lonely place when you are a new mom and a leader. Everyone's looking at you. They're asking you the oddest questions. When are you going to have another kid? How are you going to do this job? You know, what does your husband say about this? Well, what does my husband say about this? It's my body. It's my identity. And so when I shifted into that, I still was so invested, like you said, I over 100%. And you know, going into that, I was like, I'm ready for the next move. I moved into a director of special education position in another district, a very progressive district that I probably should have had a warning label with it. But you know, with that, I was the director of special education in a very litigious district, a district that, you know, had turnover as well. And here I was, you know, this person that was like, I'm ready to go all in because that was my energy, my, you know, achievement. And it's just my still, again, very a identity focused, connected to work. Until I oversaw a group of individuals. So eventually, after a couple of years of being in the thick of it, now I'm dealing with crisis. I oversee threat assessments. I oversee DCFS. I oversee special education behavior. So I was in it. Not to mention when my beginning of my time there, I was wrapped up in union issues. I was wrapped up in parent complaints, due process cases, and so I wasn't even able to do the proactive work that I wanted to do. Because my first year, I'm not even joking, I was on a laptop in my office 8 hours a day, pretty much getting yelled at. And my plants were dying, and that was a problem. And so, with that being said, I now brought in coordinators into our department that were now the front line. And so, very similar to that behavior specialist position, here's the front line now. And I saw these individuals after a year deteriorating and watching them fall apart. And I just couldn't help them. It was a systematic issue. And I tried and I kept being there and trying to be that safe person for them. And I was getting knocked down and they were getting knocked down. And we were fighting upstream. And it was just like no one was there to throw us a floaty and help us. And so, you know, because of that and other life things and the pandemic and the high level of intensity of the job, you know, I speak about a friend who I almost lost into suicide. And so having that in my face and being there to see somebody who I cared about so much fall apart and then see that as the next person who's closest to that person fall apart and then I'm falling apart. We completely unraveled as a team. We completely unraveled as individuals. And so now I'm sitting here going, what's my purpose? If my purpose isn't strong enough to fight against these, you know, systemic issues, to fight against these people who are bringing us down, then why am I in education? Like, why am I here? My achievement is not getting anywhere. My heart giving 100% isn't doing anything. And I'm in this job that I was in this job, this role in special education for 17 years, and it was now killing me. It was physically killing me. And there was no sort of relief. And so when you're going into a career that you absolutely love and you don't love it anymore, and it's now killing you, and that was your sole identity, I was lost. I was completely lost. And I talk about it because it's so still fresh in my head. I had to leave. I didn't have support from administrators. I didn't have support from, you know, my previous bosses, not all, but some very important people to me. And it opened up my eyes to be like, I need to step back because this job is still going to be there. If anything happens to me, they're just going to keep going. You know, you see that that phrase all the time, like, take care of yourself because you can get replaced. Yeah, like this is very true. And easily did I get replaced after I left my job. And so, you know, with that, I left my job in mid-October, something that I loved so much, that brought me so much joy when I first started, even with all the craziness. I loved it, and I left some really amazing people, but I had to choose myself, and I had to. And ever since that moment I left that job, I have been on a healing journey to figure out what's next for me, because I no longer rely on achievement. I no longer rely on always taking care of myself, that I'm calling on and I'm calling in people, because I just never did that. So right now I'm a blank surface. Like, my identity is completely, I am a canvas right now. So dip into that, Kevin.
It is when I as I was talking earlier, last week's guest is her name's Amy Schoenthal, and she wrote The Setback Cycle, and there's a lot of parallels with her material that she wrote in that book, along with Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, which is the basis for this podcast. And there are so many times my own story of staying too long somewhere, and the resistance of my resistance of want of acknowledging the signs that I need to move on, when for a thousand different reasons, I don't give up, and to stop being a wimp about this, and all those things, just need to push harder. I mean, I remember one time I was early 20s, early to mid 20s. I was a program director working at a psychiatric hospital. Diane and I had just started dating. So this was been 2002. And no, I'm sorry, not 2002, 1992, not 2002. And I,
I
yeah,
was
exactly.
like,
Yeah.
wow,
So 92, I remember waking up. I had to be at work at, I don't know, let's say 10 o'clock or whatever it was, 'cause I worked into the evening running groups. And I remember not feeling that great, but I was like, oh, just suck it up, stop being a wimp, you'll be
right.
fine once you get to work or whatever. And I remember getting dressed and trying to push through and getting to the hospital, and walking onto the unit. I think it was the adolescent unit or whatever I was assigned to that particular part of the day. And the lead nurse looked at me, and she pulled me aside. She goes, "What's going on with you?" And I'm like, "I'm fine. What do you mean, what's going on with you?" She goes, "What's that?" And I had chicken pox.
Oh my gosh.
And so, and I, so of course, so the whole, all the units got shut down. They had to quarantine the units. I was so sick for 3 weeks. I was sick. I couldn't leave the house. I had like 100, 102 plus fever for an extended period of time. I had such a bad reaction to this virus. And I was ignoring every indicator that there was something going on, because you just suck it up. You just got, and for me, it was even double time, because this was the career that was going to replace the previous career of being a competitive athlete. And so I had to, in my mind, I was using the same thinking and logic that I had in the previous world in this one. And taking care of yourself was about achieving more. Taking care of yourself was how to have more endurance and more stamina and stronger work ethic than anyone else. That was at the misplaced self-care, and so Anna Marie, when you think of that time period, and then and this so this would have been October of 22.
That I left my job. No, October of 20, what are we in? We're in 2023, October
Oh,
2023.
okay, so we're talking 6 months ago.
We're talking, yes.
Wow, so this
Yeah.
is very fresh.
Very
Very,
fresh.
very fresh. Okay.
Very fresh.
So when you went through this time period in the fall going into the winter, And obviously the amount of courage that it took, the amount of courage to finally surrender. Tell us a little bit about that piece and then afterwards.
Oh man. Gosh, surrendering is so hard. You read books on healing and saying that it's probably the worst pain you'll ever feel, but it's like the pain that needs to happen in order for you to grow. I would want to say I don't wish that on anybody, but I wish that on people, like to have that. Because, I had to figure out who I was because I just got everything taken away. And I say that because there were some people in my life that impacted my new path. And I was angry. I was grieving. I was in denial. This can't be happening. I was going from angry to denial to I don't even know the cycle of grief, but I know I was in it. I was feeling it. I was definitely feeling it. And so I had to figure out how to handle grief, transition into a new job that I needed to put everything in. And then also try to figure out who I am. And so I was going back. I'm like, did I demote myself? Is this, because I'm no longer in a huge department. Am I going to be able to show the best version of me because I am struggling? And so all of these things are happening in my life. And so all of these older things, the past, are just surfacing, like how I didn't have a childhood because I was, raising myself because my mom was working so hard for us. And how do I rely and stop being a fixer? Someone said to me, which also was like a big aha, you're so used to fixing things. You're not a fixer anymore. You're a builder. And I'm like, what? I don't know how to be a builder. I know how to be a fixer. Can I fix and build at the same time? Like, can I figure it out? And that was just sitting in that, just it just was awful because I didn't have anything to grasp onto that anything was new to me. Even a role as a mom, I was home more. And I'm like, oh my gosh, my kids are getting used to me being home. I was home later in my previous job. So now I'm like giving them more baths and cooking dinner and figuring out how to be this new mom, but like not an improved mom. I wasn't a bad mom previously. I just am now a different mom. And, navigating my relationship, at home and with my own family. Like I've brought people into therapy. I've had very tough conversations with, my sibling, with my mom, with my husband to say, like, Anna Marie is now going to be different. Like this has forever changed her. And how do you grow with her? Because she's calling you in to help her. And that is really what has been the hardest, asking for help, saying I'm no longer in charge of myself, that I need help, I need that. And my phrase before with all of the people that worked with me, like the behavior specialists, the coordinators, I always used to tell them, you don't have to be 100% every day. But if you come in and you're functioning at 30%, let me pick up that 70% for you. And that was me. And now I'm looking at me and I'm like, I'm functioning at 30%. I need to ask people to cover my 70%. And that is probably the hardest because it's almost as if you're wrong or you're weak, like you mentioned. And so that has been my new world. Like I could still be a strong leader. I could still grow. I can still have a future as a superintendent. But this is like a growing opportunity to call people in. And so that has been really, honestly, the hardest part. People grieve. And when they talk about grief, you think about death. Except, in my current position as a residency, teacher residency developer, I've had conversations with teachers and leaders. And they're like, I don't know if I could do this. This is my second career, or I'm a single mom now. And I'm like, I get it. Your identity is about to be completely changed. You have been a teacher assistant or a substitute for 7 years, and now we're calling you in to be a teacher. Like, you're going to go through this process, you're going to go through this cycle. And so I think also to talk about that is really important because, it's just some people don't connect that. And I have been grieving. I'm still grieving. And so I'm pretty honest about it.
Well, in so many examples, right? We talk about the hero's journey. We talk about spiritual traditions and wisdom traditions that talk about this idea that to be born anew, you have to death. There has to be a death, and we're always referring to that death of something, right? Is metaphorical for now. It's not a physical death, but it is. Hitting that bottom in the death of the active alcoholic or the active addict or of a lifestyle or of a mindset of how we do that. And that death doesn't come lightly and doesn't come easy. We hang on way too long for all the reasons because the idea of whatever it is that we're hanging on to is something that we've developed up to this point, and we're not going to let go of it lightly because we actually believed it was working for us. And it was for a while until it wasn't. And then this chasm, this unknown, when, and sometimes we're fortunate enough that when we have this death, that it's like the old story about, I don't know if it was Alexander the Great or Napoleon or whatever, that he sent his men, off the boats to get ready to attack, and then he ordered the boats to be burned so that surrender or retreating was not an option, that we either are going to be victorious or we're going to die. That's it. These are the choices, right? And I think that's a whole nother element of trying to move from the concept of wanting, knowing that we have to recreate ourselves versus how do I make it look like it was my familiar before? And we play with that. So Anna and Maria, I want I, so this is gonna be this is gonna be one of those questions that I want you to kind of just ponder a bit, and then we'll kind of jump into it. So, as a leader, for most of us, it's been counterintuitive, or maybe even directly discouraged, for us to be vulnerable in front of the people that we're leading. And then in some cultures, even more so. And we can talk about ethnic culture as well as work cultures, right? That to be vulnerable, to show that you don't know, to show that you are having stuff going on, seems to be extremely discouraged or counterintuitive. So tell us a little bit about, for you, what have you experienced as you have continually put yourself in a position now to be in that vulnerable space?
Oh, that is a tough question. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, my eyes are just, they're watering. So I first want to say that I didn't want to say it took an article, but it kind of took an article. So I read this article. It was a leader that talked about how she had to go on mental health leave. She was burned out. And she was afraid that her boss was going to look down on her for going on mental health leave. She just couldn't do it anymore. She was a district leader. And she said when she came back on mental health leave, she was worried about what her boss was going to think about her. And her boss, when she came back, looked at her and said, "All right, are you ready to be the keynote speaker?" And she's like, "What? You believe in me to do that job, like that big of a job after I came back on mental health leave?" And the boss is like, "Yeah, you're still an amazing worker. You still bring all of these things. You just needed respite, right?" And so I remember reading that article, but I was also living the exact opposite. I was leaving some leaders that weren't supportive of me falling apart, were really giving me emails of concern, were, not there for when I needed them. And that created an even stronger purpose for me to be like, this is not okay. If we're not a leader to support that, if we're not someone to show our vulnerability, then we're telling our people that it's not okay to fail, it's not okay to make mistakes, it's not okay to be human. And that's not what we need in this world, especially what's going on in education, where we're being less humane and more business-like. Like as a leader, like we need to be able to be that vulnerable self to share with others, hey, I'm having a rough day today. This is what happened to me in the morning, and I just need a minute. This humanizes me. It doesn't make me a bad leader. It doesn't. And that's, we read all these self-help books about leadership. There's tons of those out there. But truly it is that, bringing back that being a leader is almost, you are somebody who is seen to make an impact, and you have a choice. You can either be your authentic self and make a positive impact and show people that it's okay to model authenticity, transparency, integrity, or you have a choice to show people that you are numb and just going with the flow and okay with whatever education brings you. And so that's your choice. And these past leaders had a choice to help me, and they didn't. And so my choice is to learn from that and to be like that article and say it's okay to not be okay. And moving forward, because if we're expecting that from our teachers and our families to be vulnerable and our kids to come and answer questions, like how are you feeling today? Why can't leaders do that too? And so I think it's just really important.
Well, I think it is I similar to going back to when we did the group, right? That is that if we I remember where we were sitting. Well, we always sat the same you and I sat in the same spot, then naturally everyone else sat in the same spot. And because of where you sat, 9 out of 10 times you were going to go first because you were to the left of me in the oval slash circle. And I think that was critical, thinking about it now, even though it wasn't planned, it was what was being offered for you to be able to then model for the group that you were going to go there. And that I think that is so critical for leaders to understand. Now, you said something earlier, and this idea of be our authentic self. And I know you've already shared this a little bit, but this is what you're working with your therapist on. What if I don't know what my authentic self is? Maybe I only know what I created to survive. And so being our authentic self is sometimes also discovering our authentic self while we're walking, right? I mean, and I think that is to give people permission, modeling it for them, and then giving them permission, inviting them into that. When someone says, "Oh, I know what my authentic self is," I'm like, "Oh shit, here we go." Now we're gonna have to break that down, because because that's gonna be a two to three session setback, because they actually believe they know. So,
Man, I'm laughing so hard because I was like, okay, joke's on you, buddy.
yeah, exactly. So Anna Maria, I know that we have so much more we could d dive into, and I definitely want to set up a time period for us to come back and dive more into your story and the fact that you have recently written your story and what that experience has been about. So would it be all right for us to do a part two
Of
and have you
course.
come back on another time?
Of course, of course. And then you never asked me what I do for fun.
Yes. What? Okay. So yeah, it's a
We
great
have
way
to
for
end
us.
on a positive note.
Yes.
Okay. So what I do for fun is I make t-shirts. So I have to show you. This is a t-shirt I just made. We're having a student forum. It says Women Lift Up Women, hashtag SD308 Girl Bosses, because it is National Women's Month. And so a huge part of just who I am, my authentic self, is always lifting women up. And so I had to share about my t-shirt making. It's not professional. I don't have, any Cricut or anything, but I do the old fashioned iron on. So leave that with that. And I would love to come back and talk with you, Kevin.
Awesome. Well, Anna Marie, it is always, it's always energizing and a joy to just spend time with you. And I'm glad that we were able to capture this conversation. So for some of our listeners to recognize that, as Brené Brown talks about in a lot of her work and a lot of her research, that to be courageous enough to be vulnerable. Right, to face those demons and the fear that is around that is true bravery. And you are modeling that right now. So Anna Marie, I applaud you and honor you for the work that you're doing right now on you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So as you listen to Anna Marie tell just a little bit of her story, and we were going to definitely take advantage of having her back on the show to continue this. If there is someone that may need to hear this, regardless if they're an educator, a leader, or someone that is emerging into those roles, please share this episode and know that there is hope, no matter how dark it feels. And Anna Marie is a great example of that, as well as she is developing her authentic self right now and discovering that, and then modeling that for not just other women, but other people in general. So thank you again for being here, and I look forward to being with you next week.
Thanks, Kevin.